Good evening, everybody. My name is Helena Kennedy, and I'm the principal at Mansfield College. And let me welcome all of you to the last in our Mansfield series of lectures on a Friday night of talks. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you to Professor Julia Hobsbawm. That name Hobsbawm will be very familiar to many people in this room. Julia Hobsbawm is a businesswoman. She founded the knowledge networking business, which is known as Editorial Intelligence. And she writes and she teaches and she gives speeches on many different topics around entrepreneurship, on the issue of business of networking, on women in business, on work-life balance. She's a mother of quite a number of children, both as her own children and her stepchildren. And we have five children. And business productivity. She is the world's first professor in networking, having been made an honorary visiting professor by London's Cass Business School. She's the author of several books and articles covering communication, business and the media, and the future of the workplace. She presented and wrote herself a five-part BBC Radio 4 series called Networking Nation, and she's currently writing a new book about the connected worker, networks and the concept of social health, which is going to be published in 2017. Julia became, I think, perhaps publicly known when she was running a very successful ethical PR company, which was Hobsbawm Macaulay, and she was in business with Sarah Brown, who then went on to marry Gordon Brown. We knew her as Sarah Macaulay in those days, but she was the partner with Julia in a PR business. But Julia went on to create a business of her own, which was of a rather different order, which is Editorial Intelligence, and a rather extraordinary and unusual business it is too, and she'll tell you more about it in the end. So it's my great honour and pleasure to introduce you to the one and only Julia Hobsbawm.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for your time. One of the things I'm going to talk about is what a precious commodity time is. I'm not going to talk to you about networking as you may know it, and in fact, often people are terribly disappointed and say, why didn't you tell me the best way to hold a cocktail stick at a party and all the normal frivolities that are associated with networking. And the truth is, I believe that the essence of networking is connectedness and the exchange of information and knowledge, and I think that underpins absolutely everything we hold dear in society. And I don't think we understand or explore enough what it means in a modern context. And I suppose what I want to talk to you about today, and hopefully a relatively easy on the eye, easy on the ear, Friday, 5 o'clock, you know, exploration, is a concept about how we understand what it means to be connected and to be connected with a currency which is as valuable as a financial currency. And the reason why I've used the term social capital, even though it's even harder to define accurately than networking is because, of course, the term capital immediately makes everybody prick up their ears and go, okay, that's something of value. And what I want to put to you this evening is that the value of connectedness in a connected age is not to be underestimated. Why? Because we're at a moment when society is in huge, great transition and flux. Huge pockets of the economy don't function properly. Huge pockets of the public space don't function adequately. And I argue that effectively they're not connected enough. They're not joined up enough. And I also I'm going to argue, I'm trying to connect and join up all my various different things here, the books, the podium, the water, so I'll just bear with me one minute. I also want to connect you to the thought about what the word social means. because 50 years ago next year, the World Health Organization defined health as physical, psychological, and social. And I don't think 50 years later we've even begun to explore what social means. And social is often the most tossed off term, you know. Social means it's sort of light, and it's to do with, you know, Facebook. But actually, Facebook itself has become massively important politically. You know, the political parties are actually bypassing all mainstream media as much as possible and running directly off social media. So social capital alone in that context is interesting to me. But I do start, if you like, with a caveat that it's incredibly difficult to define what social capital is. And probably the most interesting description I came across came from a book that is completely neglected and one of these books that is published and everybody looks over and then revisits, called Connexity, How to Live in a Connected World by Jeff Mulgan. It was published by Harvard Business Review about 15 years ago, which is in fact exactly the moment when a new energy began to come into the space around what interests me, which is the nexus and the connection between behavioural science, neuroscience, sociology, behavioural economics, technology. And in Connexity, Jeff Mulgan wrote that social capital is the most valuable recent concept for understanding society's capacities to regenerate themselves and their citizens' abilities to form reciprocal relationships with others. The idea that there might well be a social and as well as a human and financial capital was first put forward about 50 odd years ago. So the other context to put against all of this before I start to get onto the easy on the eye bits is the fact that what we're witnessing in this space is pretty new. It's really only been about 50 years that we've begun to explore the interconnectedness between robust mathematical science, network science, the physics of science and networks, and the softer, soft power implications, if you like, of networks. So I'm going to talk to you about an astronaut, a particular astronaut, a little bit later on in the talk, and how this particular would-be astronaut is embodying what I think good social capital, social health is about. And I'm also going to talk about the difference between a jazz orchestra and an orchestra and a jazz ensemble, and why that's relevant to a sort of new way of thinking. And I'm going to begin with a personal bit of history, and that is me. My husband, who does all the washing up, laughs at this picture because it's probably that long ago that I was ever allowed near the sink. But that was me in the 60s, about the time that concepts of social capital were coming in. And the reason why I show you that picture of me is because one of the defining characteristics of this age, of this connected age, is not just so much the selfishness, the selfie, the narcissism, all of that that we're pretty well aware of, but it's that we as individuals who work, and most of us work and work and work and work and work, are living in what I call a blended self. That the era of sort of walking over here to the office and possibly having a uniform and then walking over here and home and taking off your hat and coat, and, you know, all those wonderful Iris Murdoch novels about, you know, the separated academic lives, it doesn't work like that anymore. We're all, you know, tweeting and texting and connected and always on, and we take our work home and we take our lives with us. And so we need to understand things in a different context. And I would love to say this is also me, but it isn't. It's a slightly glamorous version of me on the treadmill. But the reason why that's a relevant slide is because of this point about physical, psychological, and social health being linked. And another reason for putting up that slide is because 25 years ago, I'm sort of plucking that figure, 25 years ago, none of us had a sort of innate literacy around health and fitness in the way that we do now. You know, we'd all be puffing away on cigarettes and, you know, we might sort of... But people who went to the gym were a bit freaky, bit sort of extreme sport people, weren't they? Now everybody in this room can tell you the calorie count, the carb, the protein, the whatever, because we've just, as almost osmotically, begun to understand our health and our fitness. And that interests me because, as Alvin Toffler wrote in Future Shock, you get this incredible shortening of the period of time in which ideas move from sort of being out there to being completely current and normal. And I believe that a literacy around knowledge, networks, connectedness, social capital is going to become much more embedded in society, probably over the next 5 years, but it hasn't happened yet. So those of us who go on about it and practice it are sort of still a bit treated like the nutters in the string vests in the gyms in San Francisco. But Robert Putnam is probably the best known proponent of the concept around social capital. He wrote a very interesting book called Bowling Alone in 2000. Again, it's all really recent, this stuff. And the reason why I put that slide up is just that, in essence, where does all this sort of conversation belong? It does belong in this canon around what does well-being mean and what's well-being's link to productivity. And I think, really, what I think social capital represents is that we need to stop trying to make everything black and white and make everything measurable in a metric that just doesn't work with this stuff. We need to say, let's understand more what good, joined up, collaborative thinking, acting does, and what are the prices we pay if we don't do it. And then let's worry about how we data capture. You know, let's worry about that, because we sort of know instinctively that to be alone and unconnected, again, quoting WHO, I think it's true that the largest single cause of death is kind of isolation and loneliness more than anything else. So this stuff does matter. And, you know, in the end, it's about networks and the behaviour of networks and therefore the behaviour of people. And so I believe that there is a direct link between the scientific, mathematical interpretation of networks and social capital and social health. That's what I would like us all to become interested in over the next 5 to 10 years. And we do so in a difficult time. We do so in a time which is so speeded up, it bears no relation to how we live as humans. I mean, it's obviously gorgeous and wonderful that we can be on Twitter and watch a million television channels and have access to so much information. And I'm absolutely not, like my friend Andrew Keane, a complete naysayer of the digital age. But, it really does disconnect us to how we live. So if I was offering you, good people of Oxford, a webinar right now, would you have come here to this room at 5 o'clock on a Friday to watch me digitally? Not really. Because you actually still, you know, I'm looking at your faces and I'm taking a read off you and you're taking a read off me. Diplomats even say that you smell a room, you smell a kind of pheromone. So the point I'm making is that we are living out of sync in our expectations about how we actually behave. How we behave is in a much more intimate, slow way. So if I asked anyone in this room, What do you live around the number 168? Would anyone know what that number is?
Hours a week.
Oh, okay. You're the one person who ever gets it right. Yes, hours in the week. But it's, you know, when you say that, people don't really think of themselves as beings who operate around a finite clock. Because everything we're sold and encouraged around this new social world is basically a celebration of the infinite. And whilst that's good, it's also pretty out of control. It doesn't leave us feeling healthy. It doesn't give us a good navigation. And so the tyranny of time, I think, is very real. The caveat is obviously we know we're not at this point, and we're lucky for it, in a collapsing economy. We're not in a refugee camp. We're not living with a virulent virus. So we have what the pollsters call the I feel lucky syndrome. We know that we're lucky, but actually those of us who work are under the cosh in a very difficult way. And that presents problems, because when you're under attack, you close in. You close in and you hunker down and you kind of don't look left and don't look right. And that's the opposite of an expanded, connected mindset. But the tyranny of time is very real, and it's one of many obstacles to achieving this vision that I haven't even really begun to express, but that is something to do with this concept of social capital, social health. It's all about that intimacy in a big, big world, and that is much, much harder to achieve than we think, because most of us do have to operate, you know, in a silo, in a working day, with all sorts of constraints. But we get anywhere in our development around ideas and policies and actions really through the 168 number rather than the infinite number. We do it in a finite number of hours. We do it with a finite number of people. And so I just want to give you a rule, as I am a professor, even though I'm not quite the professor my late father was. I'm sure I won't be the first person to note that. But I do think it's important to have a rule around this connected existence. And I would say there is a hierarchy. At the bottom is mass communication. When you go on Twitter, you broadcast. That's great. Lots and lots of things are very good for mass media. But they're not as intimate as face-to-face connection, and they take less time. So if you want the highest form of communication, the one that engenders the quality that absolutely underpins social capital in anything you read about it, back to Robert Putnam, it's trust. It's very difficult to maintain trust or to build it in a mass way, which is one of the reasons why social media, for all of its benefits, is also problematic, because trust quickly breaks down. People start, you know, baying at each other and distrusting what is said. Oh, you would say that, wouldn't you? Because, you know, there's a whole ecosystem of mistrust that goes on. It's much harder to mistrust someone who you believe because you're reading their eyes and their face and because you know them, you know. And the written word is, to all intents and purposes, I say this with a little trace of irony, obviously, in Oxford, but, you know, I'm talking email. People think that if you email, you know, you're connecting intimately. Well, you are if you're a politician and you're sending a picture of your weenie out. That is sort of oversharing and over-intimate. But in fact, in the hierarchy of communication, sending reply all is not very personal, you know. And one of the things, you know, I ask, it's always the men that like that image of the politician oversharing himself that I find in these audiences. But the point I'm making is I'm not literally saying two legs good, four legs bad, you know, never email, always pick up the phone. But I'm saying if you take the analogy of health, if you take the analogy that we need to have a mixed, balanced diet of information and knowledge and ways in which we connect, how much of your time are you guzzling Mars bars or its information equivalent, which is just guzzling those emails and not, in fact, doing something a little bit more healthy? So I also want to talk about the concept of diversity. Diversity probably, happily, is sort of knocking women off the top spot in terms of corporate speak for what is the most important thing we all need is, you know, more women empowered. And, you know, women have done a good thing for themselves in the developed world, arguing for our status and our rights. that's kind of well underway. Now what's coming into the narrative is the question of diversity, about not just different ethnicities and races and ages and abilities, physical and otherwise. The thing that's still not in the mix is diversity of opinion and diversity of ideas. And that, to me, underpins a healthy, socially, what do I say, an organisation and structure that has good quality social capital. It is one where you can sort of say, you're wrong. Wouldn't it have been great if someone had put their hand up in the room with those subprime mortgage traders and gone, hey Bob, don't know if it's such a great idea to keep reinforcing the same stuff again and again and again. So the sociologists and the social network analysis, you know, language around this, some of you may know, is homophily. You know, it's a kind of reinforcing, everybody's got the same view. So when I talk about diversity, I talk about diversity of opinion. And the strength of weak ties refers to quite a seminal paper by Mark Granovetter, an American sociologist, published in 1973, when he did some research that proved that in fact people get more jobs more easily through the strength of weak ties. It's interesting that we're coming up for the 50th anniversary in a couple of years' time of the Stanley Milgram experiment, which led to the phrase 6 degrees of separation, when Milgram sent 100 letters out from somewhere like Nebraska and asked people to send to people they knew to see how and where the letters ended up and how many links it took, and the answer was 6. It would be interesting to rework those Milgram experiments to see in 2017, does it take 6 degrees of separation? I suspect those degrees have shortened considerably thanks to LinkedIn. But what is an absolutely inalienable fact of this research and all the research that continues to come out in this area is that diversity of links yields all sorts of interesting outcomes, and that the more predictable, strong ties don't necessarily always generate what you want. So in politics, we know all about this. That's what people really mean when they mind about the establishment. It's a non-diverse mix. And part of that lack of diversity is because the social health of some communities are much less rich than others, the social capital of individuals. I mean, I, for my Radio 4 series, went to Ipswich Academy, which is, you know, a beautiful gleaming spire of a building. But, you know, the social behaviours in that school are not good. It was effectively taken over in an equivalent of special measures. And one of the teachers confided in me that part of the problem was that the community was very closed. And in fact, when they tried to take a school trip a few miles down the road to Mersey Island, one of the parents phoned up and said, I can't send my child because he hasn't got a passport. You know, that is not a community that has rich social capital. And there's no reason why that community can't develop that social capital, but it requires change. It requires behaviour change. That's what I'm interested in. I'm not really interested, because I'm not really a kind of jobbing academic, in just labelling things or even just researching things to prove the label that I'd already decided on. I'm interested in the doing. I'm interested in what actually makes change happen. That said, you know, the science of networks is completely rich. This is the most beautiful book in the world. I'm sure part of what attracted me to exploring network science is that, you know, the physicists have such amazing names. I mean, Albert Lazarus Barabashi, you know, beat that. But the mathematics and the physics and the science is absolutely undeniable around the way network properties behave in everything from the spread of ideas to the spread of ideas to the spread of technology. You know, going viral has network properties. The whole behaviour, as many, I'm going to be embarrassed after this lecture, half of you are probably sort of phenomenal scientists, but you know, the whole behavioural properties of how Ebola has probably in this outbreak been brought more or less under control is changing behaviour amongst human networks, because the medical properties of this Ebola virus have spun out of control in the way that a computer virus spins out of control. But bringing it back in is about a particular form of purely network behaviour. And so networks, as Balabashi says, are everywhere. You have to look for them. Not because I just, you know, love networks, but they really are. And they tell us about where things lead to and what connect. And it's a good framework, I find, for understanding the current state of affairs. And Jeff Mulgan, again, said an interesting remark in relation to this, and some of his more recent writings, such as his latest book, The Locust and the Bee, really regret that societies have stopped behaving in the way that some network properties of the natural world should. And I don't know if anyone here heard the lecture by Professor Henrietta Moore of UCL over the weekend. She gave a Blavatnik lecture that was recorded. And it was absolutely astounding. It was a brilliant, brilliant lecture about the future of development. And she argued de facto that the problem with development is that it is no longer reflecting the way things are naturally happening in some of the societies in which development is taking place. And she argued for a really radical reshaping and reframing of the context in which development takes place, and she quotes Weber's, you know, track jumping. So again, it's very interesting to me that we're in a moment where, you know, 100 or so years after networks have defined civilized society, the railroads, the telecommunications, we have become networks. Humans are networkers. And yet we haven't really taken that responsibility amongst ourselves and said, well, how do we behave? What does the natural world tell us that we can do that's great? What does the natural world tell us about what not to do? So here's another number. I'm sure some of you are familiar with this, the Dunbar number. And the Dunbar number, coined by an Oxford professor here, Professor Robin Dunbar, is sort of really the anthropologically proven number that's the maximum relationships any individual can connect with at any given time. Which, again, going back to this idea of Twitter and the new digital sphere, seems sort of fantastically titchy-tiny. But again, it's about the way societies from millennia really formed and shaped. And we just need to hold in balance that concept of what's real versus what the technology and the modern life is giving us and telling us is all limitless and possible. And the Dunbar number is about relationships, back to the hierarchy of communication. So what was I going on about music and jazz ensembles? Well, if you're in with me in this concept that we have a lot of the information, but we're not necessarily arranging it in the right way, or we're not valuing it necessarily in the right way, then music is quite a good place to look. And another fabulous sounding network scientist, this one's called Valdis Krebs, who's great. And he wrote, again, quite presciently, in 1996, in Esther Dyson's newsletter, we will come to Esther Dyson in a moment, "Participants improvise. Instead of setting up boundaries and rules to produce a predictable result, they start a theme, then they listen and respond to each other, looking for the groove. Sometimes it sounds quite messy." Now, another version of this way of seeing behaviour and good outcome is what Clayton Christensen, the Harvard professor, calls disruption. Okay? It's about doing what's real, but in a different way, that builds social value, social capital, social health, I would argue. And, you know, it's about being joined up. It's about not operating in a silo. It's about forming connections. And of course, when you look at the way we're structured as a society, and one of the reasons why the big society arguably didn't fail so much as was a statement of so much of the obvious, that people didn't like it being owned as a political mantra. But human beings are in fact very good at collaborating. But in some institutions, a different mindset has taken over, all the way through education, all the way through government, all the way through many, many of our our systems. You see a certain kind of competition or a desire for funding or a lack of joined upness. You know, somebody quite senior in, let's just say, government circles said to me the other day, you know, I like to operate constantly interdepartmentally as if there's a crisis, because in a crisis everybody pulls together, and when there's no crisis, they don't. And I thought, that's just so interesting, because we do know how to pull together. You know, the network, the community that built up around the Somerset floods, which went on for absolutely weeks and weeks and weeks, was an example of that. There was a really interesting vignette on the Today programme with a woman who, I don't know what she did before the Somerset floods, but she became the centre of the network. And she just said, well, you know, I put it out to my members, we need to get this moved across this bridge which is flooded, and who can do it, and who can do it. That's all it is. But it's also the way technology is mimicking the natural networks we also need to go back to as humans. You know, the best example of a network is, of course, the technology network. I don't know if anyone saw Bevan Kidron's film about the internet. I was rather jealous because, you know, I've been in love with the metaphor of Thomas Edison and his underwater cables for many, many years, and of course that's what opened her beautiful film. You know, the bundles of cables, the way in which huge, exponentially enormous amounts of data are held and transacted, it all comes down to routers and hubs and joining up points. So, you know, to sort of move towards the concluding part of this presentation about individuals figuring out their collective role in this. Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook, not without coincidence, wrote a book, very influential, called Lean In. But in fact, the action from her, call to action, was all about what she calls circles, spheres of connections and links, all of which, again, mimics our friend, the natural world. So the first question to ask yourself is how are your circles? I like to look at it also as a little bit like layers of insulation. You know, who do you call for knowledge about what's going on in the news? Who do you trust in your circle to tell you what's interesting? Who do you turn to get the job done? If you can't figure out these insulating levels, then again, that's sort of poor social health. That's like saying, well, I'm going to go to the gym and not having any strategies around it because you don't even have any running shoes. Or it's like, you know, saying, well, I do want to get physically fit, but I can't because I'm too stone overweight. I can't begin to fix it. It does require, in my view, a method of change. So what does your network map look like? And again, don't be governed, in my view, by the numbers and the scale. Be governed by the strength of weak ties. Who do you know that you trust that you might not have seen for 10 years that actually can guide you to a place you need to get to? And how can that help whatever project it is that you're thinking of getting underway? What change, if you like, you want to see? So here's our astronaut, Esther Dyson. And Esther, not quite in the Sarah Brightman league, but I think kind of, you know, she's made some money and she wants to be an astronaut, and so that's Esther in her astronaut gear. That's not why I've got a picture of her. If I was the sort of person who stood up and gave leadership development lectures, then maybe I would and say, you can do it, you can fly to the moon. That's not my thing. Esther has set up something which I believe is an absolutely perfect example of social health. And she set up something called the Way to Wellville. And she basically felt that health outcomes were stagnating in America, and that she was going to fund a series of community efforts to identify what joined-upness could create if left to the community's own devices. I'm not saying this is a world first, it's just an interesting illustration. So these are the five districts in America that won the bid. There was a competitive process, and they're all, you know, pretty small. Spartanburg, South Carolina, 37,000 in their population. Again, pretty gorgeous names, I'm sure. I'm totally biased. You know, who wouldn't want to cite an example of Greater Muscatine in Michigan? I certainly would, 79,000. And why did this entrepreneur innovate in this way? Because she wants to see change. And unlike some of social innovation and social investment strategies, which are very much around building capital and wealth for communities, this is taking a slightly different approach, which is how can we pull out the knowledge that we've already got and learn new knowledge and create new ideas? So, trying to help them achieve goals they already have. So, I've spent 10 years trying to model an iteration of this joined up thinking and ideas that falls completely outside the norm of you've got X job, you must just stay and be productive for that measurement. I'm all for boundary spanning. I'm all for mixing it up. I'm all for exploring the question of individuality in a mass age, that you belong to the collective and the greater project, but you also have your identity. And I'm pretty shocked at the low state, both the morale and the performance of the company has got to in 2015. It's pretty not okay. People are not happy. They're not thrilled. And I don't mean we can all be in a solid state of happiness, but I do believe that well-being is linked to productivity. If you're engaged, you're connected, you can develop stuff. So that's what I'm not going to bore you with the details. That's sort of a version of what we do. And I'm going to really close on the five principles that I suppose are at the heart of what I believe. I'm always asked, because I'm a professor in networking, to give tips, and it absolutely makes me wince, and I can't bear it, and it feels far too. But then I thought, okay, everyone wants them. They want, you know, doesn't matter, it bounces back like a boomerang. You know, the next journalist that emails says, can I have five tips? And I thought, how do I get over this? How do I give them the tips and not call them tips? And then I realised that, in a way, the Rothschild family are probably a very good emblem of a very productive, prolific, enduring network. Okay? Both philanthropic, both cultural, blah, blah, blah. And the shield of the Rothschild is the five arrows that Amschel Rothschild sent his five sons out from the ghetto. And I suddenly thought, that kind of works for me. I can live with five arrows. So just bear that in mind. Please don't say she gave us five tips. But they are: manage your networks like you manage the contents of your fridge. Okay? Actually own. Have you got 150 people in your network? Have you got 2,000 people on LinkedIn? Even think for half a minute about your networks. Are they in an address book? Are they in your head? What is your network? Go face to face with somebody. Never mind your five a day. Five times a week. Go just walk down the corridor or pick up the phone or just tiny, tiny change, it will make an enormous difference. And just shoot the breeze with somebody. You know, the other sort of horrible, horrible myth about networking is the idea that it's sort of very transactional. I'm terribly sorry, I really blame the Americans for that. And think lifestyle, not diet. You know, it just isn't I'm going to get thin overnight. Forget all that. It's about sustainable, it's about building long term. Curiosity and generosity is the definer of it. If you're only out for yourself, then you're bowling alone. You're never going to it's so much more rewarding and beneficial to help somebody else. So in other words, I've read this interesting piece of information. Can I share it with you? Or anyway, you don't need a lecture on generosity, but generosity, reciprocity, curiosity are absolutely central tenets, I think, of social health. And the reason for the knowledge dashboard is in the same way that people have no real management or concept of their networks and they just sort of, you know, on the whole, blindly stumble around with them. The same is true of their knowledge. When you say, well, do you have a sort of strategy around this tsunami of information that you're taking in? Do you read long, short? Do you listen to something? Do you watch something? Do you... But people don't. And sometimes that means they just tune out. Sometimes that means they just have The Economist and they don't open it, but they feel like they've read loads. But I would like to probe a bit and say social capital is absolutely linked to what you know about things and nothing to do with your space, because that's the world we live in, a connected world where somebody else in a different time zone, in a different economy, with a different thing, they know something you don't know. And either you're going to help each other or they're going to flatten you. So it's quite self-preservation. This, I think, is really difficult for academics, by the way, because you're learning a subject inside out, and I'm sort of saying, yeah, well, you know, add on another 20% of stuff that is completely irrelevant to the day, the task at hand. And I wrote a paper for EY, Ernst & Young, who are deeply, deeply concerned about what the next workforce is going to look like, and if anyone's interested, that's on my website. So I would like to conclude by saying I'm not bothered by the fact that this is all rather new and a bit nebulous. It doesn't matter. It's got a truth embedded in it, which is there in the science, it's there in the social science, and it's there in the way we all experience this current imprecise age of overload. And I think if we say the World Health Organization was right 50 years ago, there is a form of health that we're overlooking. Not that we've got it perfectly nailed down on health, physical and psychological, but we're kind of cognizant of it. I think we would do very well if we agree that the next chapter of literacy is social health. Thank you.
Julia, I'm going to take my chair of privilege of probing a number of the ideas that you're playing with. Robert Putnam's work was something that I was very interested in when I was working with the British Council. I was chairing the British Council back in the late 90s and into the early 2000s. And it was about, because Putnam's work started when he started doing research looking at, in fact, northern Italian cities, which relied upon where there was a very strong social networks, and he was very interested in how that social network created real communities that were at ease with themselves, where people did spend time around tables enjoying food and enjoying the chewing the fat and talking about the state of the world or just their families or whatever. But they also supported each other and helped each other and helped each other to boy's coming up and he's got problems. Well, you know, that's it almost was like it was part of it was the community's issue as well as anybody's. And he felt that in many parts of the world, certainly he was looking at America, that you were seeing suddenly a breaking up of all of that. And so that's why he wrote the book, which was the idea of bowling alone.
Yeah.
That you can't, that people, social networks were breaking up, that people were not any longer belonging to clubs or the Elks or the whatever it was, and that the people didn't, they were spending too much time knackered and sitting falling in front of the television with a glass or with a beer and not connecting. And as a result, you were seeing the strength of communities was disappearing. And so he started doing his research and work around that kind of, if you like, diminution of social capital. And one of the things that we rather kind of, sort of probably slightly complacently here in Britain felt was that actually Britain is rich in social capital. The UK has probably, and we were interested in this issue of social capital because we were looking at what is it about, and for example, it's about all those things that folk join, as well as anything else. I mean, you're looking at the new technology, but it's also about belonging to Amnesty International or belonging to the local tennis club, and it's belonging to the WI and a million different things. And people in Britain were big belongers and joining up and joining into things. And we're beginning to see the same kind of slowing up of that stuff, of people getting out of the house and joining things. And so the question I think that people would be asking about this is that a lot of the connection is being replaced because technology does give you a semblance or a kind of like a sensation of it, which in some ways is not totally real. I'd like to talk about it in terms of our social, our communities and our social relationships and what's happening to relationships, But I also wanted to talk about it in relation to the world of work, because of course it's changing too, and there's no doubt that there are those for whom networks exist that are very beneficial to them, and they're very privileged to belong to those networks. I mean, we see it. I mean, Oxbridge creates networks. You leave Oxford, and the fact that you've been to Oxford, and then you stumble into the workplace, and you meet some other fit person that's been to Oxford, and you immediately able to say, "Oh, which college did you go to? Yeah. Oh, did you know Charlie so and so?" And people do all that stuff. So the place that you went to creates networks, and they're elite networks if you've been to Oxford or Cambridge. But of course, even within Oxford, there are, if you like, very special networks, which are of a different kind, and which are about the people who went to not just Oxford, but who went to certain schools, and those schools create their networks, so you get a double layering of networking. And then there's, of course, the folks who belong to the Bullingdon Club, or whatever clubs you belong to. So there are multiple ways in which it creates exclusivity, which can be very, excluding, right? Yeah. And so networks, I feel that it's a bit like it's a bit like community, which sounds nice to us, but community also has an underbelly, because bad things happen in communities. Closeness of community can suggest nice stuff, but it also covers up bad stuff like child sexual abuse or women being battered but nobody talking about it and all kinds of stuff,
Yes, I mean, I guess in a way what you're describing is this tension of scale again that really interests me. So the Italy example is really interesting. Fukuyama also did some work on this around the mid-90s, around trust. And essentially, what the evidence seems to show is that the kind of economic development you get in very small, intimate communities, where trust is very high and very familial, are sort of familial-based industries, fashion and textiles and almost sort of exported cottage industries, and that America, funnily enough, has got such a track record of enormous corporations. And I'm sure this data is old now because of China and Brazil and India, but actually it is the Americans' ability to boundary span any network and be anybody and not be constrained generally that means they could create such ginormous corporations. And so the point is that in some cases huge ambition and scale around these communities, and you can be anything and you can be anyone, is great, but there also needs to be a specificity and a focus, because we want exclusivity actually as individuals. And I think it's a mistake to say the elitism of Oxbridge is fundamentally wrong. I think what you want to do is create the energy and the exchange and the trust in which things are learned in all sorts of communities. And that's what I think is missing. And I understand, and I'm frequently told, in fact, a very major broadcaster shouted at me at a lunch the other day and said, he never benefited from any network of any kind, and I was just propagating an evil idea. And it was quite weird and ranty, actually, because it was A, untrue, and B, I wonder whether this isn't how the establishment wants to keep it. That only they do the great networking and nobody else should learn how to do it, or God forbid, be able to do it. Yeah. And my point is, if you understand what it is, it's not very complicated and it's free and everybody can do it. But you have to boundary span. You have to know that you don't need a passport to go to Mersey Island, and you have to go to Mersey Island.
Mm. Mm.
And that is, in a sense, the problem. So it is. The other point I'm trying to make here is that networks, it's not just about who you know. I mean, it is if you're in a corrupt system where it only counts if you say. I mean, the Masons, the Freemasons, obviously were.
A
network that was created on the grounds that if you were in, brother, were you in? You didn't have to prove yourself beyond that. Actually, I'm interested in a different kind of network where if you know something and share it and find your way to someone else who knows it, and then there's an equality there. And to that degree, technology's a great enhancer of that. You have to give that to technology.
Yeah, because it isn't layered in the way that you're describing,
yeah.
and is porous and much more open.
Yeah.
But
the social skills, the confidence to look in someone's face at the top of that hierarchy of communication, to feel uncertain and go with it anyway, that is actually a wealth, a capital that is much more prevalent in socioeconomic groups that earn more. Because culturally, there is a shyness, a huge shyness. And so I think people like Anthony Jenkins at Barclays are absolutely right to say, you know, the next generation of workers have got to be able to do the really basic stuff, shake hands, look in the eye, all that. If I could wave a magic wand, I want to set up a sort of national network called Talent to Work, where we all have to kind of mentor somebody just in the art of walking into a room and hanging out. I mean, that's how you learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.